Pauline, would you be kind enough to just tell me where you were born and where you were...
I was born in Islington, yes, right in the middle of London. Yeah. But we moved fairly soon when I was... Well, my younger sister was born there, so we must have been there at least 4 years.
That's okay. So your parents did what? What did they do for a living?
My mother was from Edinburgh, and my father was from London, and he joined the RAF, but not just as a young man. He was a cabinet maker, but he was in the First World War, sergeant, and he was in the British Expeditionary Force that was sent over there before the war was declared.
Right.
And he said, strangely enough, there were men over there fixing Rolls-Royce engines to German planes, and they were working when war was declared, but they had to finish it in order to be paid. So, you know, it's strange, isn't it, really?
So this is at the beginning of the First World War? Or
no, this was the second course, because he was on the reserve,
right?
And
okay.
So he was in the British Expeditionary Force, and he didn't get back till after Dunkirk. We thought we'd lost him, and it turned out that they couldn't get to the beaches, so they were going south all the way, and they were travelling at night and hiding in the day in orchards right through France. And he managed to get back in rags. He had no, you know, it took some while. I don't think we know how long it took before he got back. I wish I'd asked him, but you didn't think of it then. You're young, you're full of your own life, and of course I was in the Air Force. So, yes, I wish I'd asked him about it more.
And did he remain in the, you know, as a member of the armed forces then throughout the war?
Yes.
Right, okay. So what did he do when he, after he'd come back?
Well, he went back, he did a bit of work for different firms, but he had ill health and he retired soon afterwards. But...
Right, okay. And so you were brought up in Islington.
No, I wasn't brought up four. So she said we moved to Higham Road in Tottenham, and a neighbour there was an Arsenal player, Bob John, and I got friendly with his daughter Joyce, and he was ever such a nice man, Bob John, and we used to go. They lived about two or three doors away from us in the same block of houses. And in those days, I don't think they went and trained like they do today. They used to train at home. Mm-hmm. And he was always skipping. They had a sort of a paved area at the back of the house. And we used to have our skipping ropes, and the three of us used to skip together. So, but then there was the recession. My father lost his job, and my mother had to sell the house. It was always in her name. Had to sell the house, and we moved to Southgate, North London, and we lived there, and then the war came. Mm-hmm. We had a landmine that landed at the side of us. We were a little joining road with two houses either side of the road. It was a link road, but two long roads. And then one day this landmine, I was actually on leave. When I used to go home, the first thing I'd do was have a hot bath, because it was very difficult circumstances there. That was when I would be at Hornchurch, I think. You had to walk to the bathhouse, quite a walk from where we were billeted, and you had to take your towel and that. And of course, there were never any plugs there, but we found that if we wrapped a handkerchief around a penny, that worked as a plug. So you could have a bath. And of course nobody ever cleaned them. So But so, of course, as soon as I got home, I had a hot bath at home.
Mm-hmm.
And while I was in the bath, this landmine landed on the link on the road that ran to the side, and a terrible crash, of course. And it blew in our front door. It smashed the side window. We had a side window on the stairs. And my mother called out, and of course, no, we had couldn't put the lights on because the blackout had come down. And she said, "Be careful you come down, there's broken glass on the stairs." So, of course, I wrapped the towel around me and I managed to get down without doing much of an injury of anything. And, of course, it wasn't till daylight when we looked out at because the front door was blown up. I don't know if it was blown up or blown in. I think it was just blown in. And when we looked out, there were the row of houses at the side there, and it was like a gap in a tooth. Two of them had gone down. One of them, because the men were at war, it was just the wife and I think it was just one child, and they'd taken cover under a thick oak table, and they survived. The whole house had collapsed on them, but they survived. But the couple on the next house, or I don't know how many there were there, they didn't. So, yes, that was a bit of a shock.
Oh dear. Yes. Yes. But you left school and you became a draftswoman. Is that correct?
Well, I was working to begin before the war started, or had it just started, at Standard Telephones and Cables. I don't know if you've heard of the firm.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, in those days, you had lots of tracers. It was a building, the whole top floor, at one end there were the draftsmen, and at the other end the tracers. There must have been about 20 tracers. And of course, the idea, of course, was that we would trace the drawings and do all the printing, because it was almost illegible, their printing. So we had to make a really decent job that then could be copied and sent to the workshop or whoever was going to make something. And of course, we were on war work then. It must have been the war had started. And of course, I know I was working on air conditioning for a warship. Well, of course, the draftsmen, as I say, although it was a they could stay, but they were joining up. You know, they felt they had to go and do their bit. So, of course, they were losing all their draftsmen. So they chose five or six of us, the better tracers, as they put it. And we were being taught draftsmanship. Well, I got well into the course. I hadn't quite finished it. And then my husband, who was in the Air Force, came home on leave, because he was going abroad. What should they call it? There's a name for it. But anyway, so he had a fortnight's embarkation leave. That was it, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So I asked if I could take my. That was round about February, I think. No, well, January. I know it was in the middle of winter.
So is this 1941, perhaps, or?
42.
42.
Beginning of 42.
Right, okay.
And I asked if I could take my summer leave, you know, to spend it with him.
Yes, indeed.
And it was refused. So I took it anyway, and when I went back, I was given the sack. So, unbeknown to me, the other draftsmen that were there took it up with the union. I didn't even know that I could do anything like that. So, they took it up with the union, and I had to go before a panel of elderly men, very sympathetic, you know, that my well, we just got engaged actually, so my fiance, all the story, you know, mm-hmm. and they decided that it was unfair dismissal and I could go back. But in the meantime, I got myself a job at Cosser's as a draftswoman. They were just grateful to get anybody who had any idea. But I wasn't allowed to take it, because then my I was conscripted. I was kept waiting, I think, for 5 weeks until my conscription came through. Mm-hmm. And that's how I went into the Air Force. Mm-hmm. Looking back, though, it was such an interesting time. I'm glad I did go into the Air Force.
Mm, absolutely.
Because I found it was so interesting. I was very lucky.
Your fiancé at that stage, he was air crew?
No, he wasn't. He volunteered, but he was signals. He had to learn Morse code, and he used to listen out and take down, you know, from the Germans and that sort of thing, take down, and then of course somebody else.
He was a ciphers officer.
Yeah.
Ciphers.
Well, yeah.
Person. Yeah.
And after 3.5 years, he got leave. He came home for a fortnight. We got married, special license, and then he went back to Egypt. He was in Egypt. He'd been all over the place. Mm-hmm. Malta and Sicily. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that was that.
Yeah. So you entered the RAF. You presumably were posted somewhere for,
well,
basic training.
As a plotter.
Yes.
It was a plotter.
But you were posted for some initial sort of basic training, first of all.
Oh, yes, Innsworth, I think it was.
Innsworth.
Where we used
in
to
Gloucester.
Go. Oh, it was an enormous. You were kitted out with your uniform there.
Yes.
And then you were interviewed to see what sort of work you'd be suitable for.
Right.
And they decided I'd be a plotter. So I was doing that for about... 6 months, but a while anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And that was at Hornchurch, and we had a draftsman there who had his own office, and he was mad on table tennis, and there was a table there for quiet times or rest times, and he just wanted to play table tennis. He was there, and of course it must have been on my papers that I'd had drawing office training, so I was approached and said, would I like to be his assistant in the drawing office? So I said, well, yes, you know, it sounded interesting, because I always enjoyed drawing. So I was there for about a week or a fortnight, I can't be sure now, and he was posted overseas. They wanted to get rid of him because he was never there. He was always playing table. So of course I had my own little drawing office all to myself. And
so he had a good war.
I don't know what happened to him.
Right.
I really don't know whether he survived. But I suppose he annoyed them because he was never in the office. And of course I did all the work that came in. That was painting the plaques that used to go around the ops room, hung on a rail that went round, and all the different squadrons that came, you had to put the number, you know, 3, 2, 1 or whatever it was.
Yeah.
And of course they were always changing, so that meant repainting them. And then they decided that, because I mean I did my best, but they varied, they weren't always the same figures, so I had to make templates, draw them out, and then they were sent over to the workshop and they made them, so I had them, the stencils, but so they all looked identical with the figures. That was one thing. And then of course, because when I was at Hornchurch, they decided they wanted a bigger plotting table, because it only covered a small area, and so I had to make we were billeted at Hornchurch, and then there was a coach that used to drive us in, the different crews, into Romford, and at the back there, there was a very big building that had belonged to, well, it'll come to me later on.
Okay.
And so I spent ages making this bigger table. Now, I know it came from the wash down, it just included the Isle of Wight. And it took me ages to do. And then almost as soon as I'd finished it, they decided to close Horne Church and we were all moved to North Wales. But of course, I was in the drawing office there. We were at Blake Hall, which was a lovely country house, away from the airfield for obvious reasons. It looked like a like a sort of farm. It was a big building, and I had one of the front bedrooms as my drawing office, which was very nice, and it had a sink in it, which for washing my instruments and things. So that's where I stayed until the end of the war at Blake Hall.
And I mean, when you were at Horne Church and indeed at North Wales, I mean, those were very active fighter.
Oh, it was.
Stations.
Yes, it was. And we used, and we had our mess right on the edge of the airfield, and we could see the planes going off. And very often we'd stay there. This was when I was a plotter. We'd stay there and try and count them as they came back. And you know, so often they didn't all come back. It was very upsetting. And of course, you've got to know them.
Yes.
Some of the pilots. And,
yes.
Yes.
And can you remember the squadrons that were there?
I can't. There were so many of them because they were always changing.
Yes, they were.
We had a Polish one. We had a Polish, all Polish.
Yeah.
Now that's an interesting story, because all the Poles were tall and slender and quite elegant. They always liked to press their uniforms a certain way. Very particular. Now, when I was at North Weald, getting towards the end of the war, they'd been rescued. There were a lot of Polish girls, and I feel uncomfortable saying this, but they were the peasant type. Nothing like the men, the pilots. They were all about 5 foot tall and about 5 foot wide, like peas out of a pod. And they had come because they didn't know any English, and they were in the mess, the dining room, and because they didn't know what to do. And I tried to be helpful. I got my schoolgirl French, which wasn't much use, but at least I was trying to help them, and they were so grateful, and sort of almost sign language. Would I visit them that evening, you know, when we were all off duty? And it was summertime, I remember, lovely sunny day, and we were in these long huts, you know, the sort, an entrance both ends. And all ours were in, it was called the rookery, because there were trees there. It was all, you know, disguised really, because the rooks used to nest in the tops of the trees. So where we were called the rookery. Well, I went to their hut, and as I say, there was an entrance at both ends, and I was knocking on the door. I could hear chatter going inside, so I knew they were all there. And I tried to push the door, wouldn't open. And I was banging away at it, and suddenly one of the girls came out. Oh, no, took me to the other door. They've got a shrine built at the end there, and I almost knocked it down. But you know what? They didn't wear their shoes inside. They were stocking feet, and the lino, it was that thick brown lino. It was like glass, it was polished. I've never seen nothing like in our huts. And they were so friendly. They were lovely girls. But we were trying to sign language in a way, you know. But of course, unfortunately, all they could do was clean. Because they used to clean all the latrines for the Germans, you know, when they were prisoners there.
Yes.
So that was all they could do, which I felt so sorry for them.
Indeed.
But,
indeed. Now, you also contributed to 2SC Rescue.
Oh, yes.
So, can you tell us about that, please?
Well, that started off by the magazine that John Armstrong brought me to read, and in it was an article about Air Sea Rescue, and it was primitive. It was in the early days, so I, because I had already done my stint, because I had a squadron leader come. I think he'd heard that I'd made the plotting table, so I was used to doing tables. And he came and interviewed me and said sort of thing that they needed, explained what was wanted, and I think I could do it. I said, well, I'll have a go. And it took me ages because there had to be a table for the North Sea and another one for the English Channel. And it consisted of, there were several, I can't remember the names now of these stations, dotted around the 11 group, it was all 11 group, and they were different colours, red, blue, green and black. And I had to calibrate each one, the four of them, all round this table. It was a large table, oval, and it had it was thick rubber, and the paint was cellulose. It was actually called Salamel at the time. That was the makers of it, and it had to be calibrated, all the degrees all the way round, and of course each one had to be calibrated differently. And then if a signal came from a downed pilot, it could be picked up by several of these stations inland. Mm-hmm. And then it was done by triangulation. You know, they all came together or went out together until you pinpointed where the downed plane was. So I had to take them down to Swingate near Dover, and they were positioned in the control tower at Swingate. And they were very successful, because after a while I had to go back and touch up the paint. The paint was wearing off because of the wear. So they were very successful. So it must have saved a lot of lives.
Indeed.
Yes.
Indeed. Yes.
So,
But did you have weighted strings as well?
Oh, yeah, yes, that's right. Because there were holes drilled through these stations inland, and it was called a mouse for the general shape of it. It was lead heavy, so it would drop through, and of course there was another thing that held it on the top. And then of course that's when they got the signal through, they'd pull it out, and that was where it crossed over the sea. Mm-hmm. That would pinpoint where the plane had gone down or whatever. Mm-hmm. Yes, the actually reminded me, Rod. Mm-hmm. So
this would have been about 1944, 45, towards the end of the war.
It would be 43 possibly.
43, oh gosh, that
might
was a lot of
might have been later, you know.
Yes, yes.
And of course you dare not record anything, you know.
No, because
it was treated with suspicion if you were making notes of anything.
Yes, indeed.
And it was only need to know sort of business.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, you mentioned earlier on that you had designs to become a pilot yourself.
Yeah, yes, that was towards the end of the war.
Right.
Mm.
Okay.
But, But having passed the medical and the interview, the war was coming to an end. So, as I said, my son said, what a good job, I didn't get it because I've got no sense of direction.
Alright, wonderful. So, when did you finish with the RAF? When were you demobbed?
I was at demobbed when my husband came home. I applied to be demobbed. So, and we've been very happy down here.
So you moved here, it sounds as if it was about 40 years ago?
About 35, 37 years you've been here?
Yeah, something like that, for a long time. Mm. Yes, on VE Day, we were all confined to camp because they were concerned that there might be a last attempt for the German, the Luftwaffe, to fly over and put all their bombs on us as the last gesture, I suppose. So we were confined to camp. Well, I wrote a letter which was printed in the Radio Times, and I got I've still got the letter, I can show it to you. A girl got in touch with me. She was in the army, but we had a small contingent of army there because when our guns were firing, they wanted to know where we were, where we were firing. So we had a small contingent of army there. And she'd read my letter, and she read my article in the Radio Times, and there was enough of my address for her to contact me. She sent me a letter, and she said, I remember that, of being confined to camp, because, I mean, a lot of people wouldn't believe it. VE Day, everybody was out celebrating, and we were confined to camp.